Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's December the 23rd. We are in Parshas Bamidbar on page 744. We are at the beginning of Perek Dal, chapter 4. Before we begin, this next chapter, I want to tell you a few things that have to do with the things we've been talking about. So, first of all, we learned that the Jews were counted from age 20 and up, 20 years old and up. The Levim were counted from what age?
1 month.
Right, from 1 month, from 30 days and up. So Rashi tells us why were the Levim counted from 30 days and up. So Rashi says because at 30 days, that's when a child is no longer Bichlal Nefel. They're out of the category of Nefel. Nefel means a child that is born that is not a viable child. So for example, if God forbid a child is born and the child is not a viable child, the child dies within the first few days of life, not through violence, but because the child was sickly and was not able to live, then that child is not considered to have ever been a fully alive human being, because the life was never viable to live long enough to be considered a viable human being. That would be any child that is able to live 30 days or more, then they are, that life is considered to be a viable life. To be clear, even a child that is 1 day old is considered to be completely alive, provided that the child is healthy enough to make it for 30 days. So a perfectly healthy child, a perfectly healthy baby is considered to be fully alive. But a child that is born and the doctors say immediately, oh, this child is not going to make it for more than 2 or 3 days, then that child is called a nafel and is not considered to be fully alive. So so at 30 days, that's when a child is no longer, everybody would understand it, whether you have a doctor there or not. Once the child is 30 days old, clearly the child is viable. So that's what Rashi says. But then Rashi adds something for why 30 days and up for the Levim. I'm going to have to find it for 1 minute, please. So back on page, if you want to look at the Rashi, it's the Rashi. On page 738, in Pasuk Tesvav, in verse 15, Rashi says, Miben Chodesh Vamala, 1 month and up, Mishiyatza Michlal Nefalim, once they've gone out of the category of Nefal, Hunimne Likare Shomer Mishmeres HaKodesh, then the Levi is counted as one who guards the guarding of sanctity. Then Rashi adds from the Medrash, Amrav Yehuda B'Rabbi Shalom, Rabbi Yehuda B'Rabbi Shalom said, Lamud Oso HaShevet, this Shevet was accustomed Leos Nimne Min HaBeten, to be counted from the womb. The Levi was accustomed to being accounted from, be counted from the womb. Shenemar, because the verse says, Asha Yolda Oso LeLevi B'Mitzrayim, referring to Yocheved, that Levi, she was born to Levi in Mitzrayim, which means Im Knisasa, as she entered BePesach Mitzrayim, to the gates of Mitzrayim, Yolda Oso, she was born. V'nimnis b'shivim nefesh, and she's counted towards the 70 souls that we had in last week's parsha, in Parshas Vayigash, when we have 70 souls counted. We know, as Rashi says, shekeshata mona cheshbonam, that when you count the Jews in Vayigash, lo simtzaim ela shivim chaser achas, you only find them to be 69, not 70, if you count all the names in Parshas Vayigash. She completed the count. Yocheved, the daughter of Levi, completed the count, going from 69 to 70. And she did so as an infant. Immediately when she was born, at that point, the Jews went from being 69 people to 70 people. So, therefore, our sages tell us that this Shevet, meaning Levi, was accustomed to being counted from the womb, meaning immediately upon being born. And therefore, the Levium are counted from 30 days and up, unlike the rest of the Jews are counted from 20 years and up. Yes?
Was she the only female counted
above 70? No. Serach Bas Asher was also counted in the 70. Yeah. Yeah.
Dina?
And I'm sorry, yes, you're right. And Dina was counted as well. Three. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. They're listed in Parshas Vayigash. But if you go through that count, you find that there's one missing. And the one missing is Yocheved, who was born to Levi when they entered Mitzrayim. Yocheved, Levi has three sons, Gershon, Kahas, and Merari, as we've already learned in Parshas Bamidbar. There's three branches of Levium. And then there is Yocheved. Yocheved married Amram, Amram being the son of Kehas. She marries Amram. The truth is their marriage is not a legal marriage after the Torah is given, because she's married to her nephew. Yocheved is Amram's aunt. Amram is her brother's son, Kehas' son. So as far as the laws of incest are concerned in the Torah, an aunt is not allowed to marry a nephew. A man is not allowed to marry his aunt. So so after the Torah is given, that relationship is prohibited. But since they married before the Torah was given, that was permitted for them until the Torah was given. So since Yocheved was counted immediately upon being born, then that this Shevet, this tribe, was accustomed to being counted from a very young age. And that's why Levi was counted from 30 days. So it sounds very nice, very beautiful, but if you think a little bit about it, there are many questions one can ask about this statement of Chazal. We'll ask a few of them. Number one, so again, Chazal are saying that since Yocheved was counted at birth, therefore, the tribe of Levi is counted at 30 days. Well, Yocheved is not the tribe of Levi. Yocheved was one daughter. She's not even considered one of the branches of Levi. The three branches of Levi are her brothers, Gershon, Kahas, and Merari. She happens to be married to one of the members of Levi. But why should that inform the entire Shevet? Just because she was counted at birth, what does that have to do with counting all of Levi from 30 days and up? Another question one could ask is that it's not like Yocheved had anything to do with this. Mm-hmm. It's not like she was born and she came out saying, count me. She didn't control when she was born. Her mother happened to become pregnant with her 9 months before they entered Mitzrayim, and she was born upon entering Mitzrayim, and therefore she was counted. But it had nothing to do with her, that she was an infant. So, are we to understand that if it would have been any other person who would have been born at that time, they would not have been counted? Are we to understand that, no, it's because it was Levi's daughter that was born when they entered Mitzrayim? Let's say it would have been Yisachar's daughter that was born when they entered Mitzrayim. Then she wouldn't have been counted? It sounds like the Torah is saying it was special for Levi. Why was that special? And really, the most significant question one could ask on this entire thing is that if you go through the names of the 70 Jews that are counted in Parshas Vayigash, you will find that several of them were children. Several of them were children. Now, they weren't infants, but several of them were children. For example, let's think about Yosef and his children. Yosef becomes the viceroy at what age when he becomes the second to the king? He's 30 years old. 30 years old. Immediately when he becomes viceroy, we have the 7 years of plenty. And then immediately that's followed by the years of famine. Mm-hmm. What year in the years of famine how many years of the years of famine pass before Yaakov and his sons come down to Egypt?
Two.
Only 2 years. So from the time that Yosef becomes viceroy until the Jews are counted is only 9 years. That's it. It's a total of 9 years. During that time, Yosef married. He married Asnas. And he had two sons, Ephraim and Menashe. Ephraim and Menashe cannot be older than eight. And likely one of them is around eight and the other one is younger. So they were certainly children, yet they're counted in the 70 souls. And they're not the only ones. Yet the Jews are counted from 20 years and up. Why don't we say, one second, why are we counting the Jews from 20 years and up? Didn't they have children who were counted towards the 70 souls? So if we're going to use Yocheved as our example for Levi, well, Yocheved was counted as an infant, therefore the infants of the Levium should be counted. Okay, then it should be, we should have some equal treatment over here. Yosef was counted from, 7 years old? So we should count the Jews from 7 years old. Why do we wait till 20 years old to count the Jews? It's a difficult connection that our sages are making between Yocheved being born and counted, and therefore the Levium are counted from a young age. So, I want to give you some insight into this to answer this question. The Gemara says in Maseches Tainis, it proves from Yosef the following rule. Now, I want to show you the verse with Yosef, and then I'll tell you the rule. If you hold the place here on page 742. Okay, hold that place. 744, actually. Yeah, hold that place. Let's move back to Parshas Miketz. We've read these parashios recently. So, if you look back at Parshas Miketz, this relates the story of Yosef becoming viceroy, marrying Asnas, and having two children, Menashe and Ephraim. So, if you look on page 230, in Pasuk Nun, verse 50, tells us, Uli Yosef Yulad Shnevanim, to Yosef were born two sons, Beterem Tavoshnas Haraav, before the years of famine began. Asha Yodalo Asnas Bas Potiphar Kohen On, that were born to him from Asnas, the daughter of Potiphar, the Kohen of On. And then it tells us the names were Menashe and Ephraim. The Gemara tells us, why does the Torah emphasize Beterem Tavo Shnas Haraav, before the years of famine began? Why is that important for us to know that the boys were born before the years of famine began? So from here the Gemara derives in Maseches Tainis, Asur lola adam l'shamesh mitaso b'shnas ravon. It is prohibited for a person to be intimate, a couple to be intimate, during years of famine. When there's a famine and people are suffering from a famine, then couples should not be intimate. Now, Baruch Hashem, we have not experienced famine, but there are times when there have been famines, and if God forbid that should happen, couples are to refrain from intimacy. So that's why the Torah tells us the two sons of Yosef were born prior to the onset of the famine. Because once the famine began, there would be no children being born because intimacy was prohibited. That's what the Gemara says in Maseches Tainis.
What's the reasoning?
It seems because when there's a famine, people are in such tsar. Uh-huh. It's such a difficult time that couples should not be involved in that.
The kids would be affected.
I don't know if the kids would be affected or if it's just the question of not engaging in that sort of practice when the world is in pain.
Uh-huh.
Be that as it may, that's what the Gemara says. Tosfos over there in Maseches Tainis asks a question. We know that Yocheved is born upon their entering Egypt. Now, if Yocheved was born upon entering Egypt, that means she was conceived no less than 7 months and probably 9 months prior to their entering Egypt. Well, the 2 years before they entered Egypt were 2 years of
famine.
So if Yocheved is born upon entering Egypt, it must be that Yocheved's parents, that would be Levi and his wife, were not adhering to this rule of the Gemara, because she could not have been conceived had they not been intimate. So it must be that Levi and his wife were not paying attention to the rule of this Gemara. Well, how could that be? Is it a rule or is it not a rule? Is it prohibited or is it permitted? The Gemara tells us that Yosef he specifically had children prior to the famine. Must be it's prohibited. But Levi clearly had a daughter during the famine.
Is it because one's mechutz laaretz, one is in the land?
Okay, you're suggesting that, well, Yosef was in chutz laaretz, Levi was in Eretz Yisrael.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Then what? That it would only be prohibited if you're outside of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, what do you want to say?
It was before the Torah was given, right?
So now, yes, but Yosef was...
Some things are allowed, and this is confusing to me.
Good, right? good question.
And but some things are not. So.
I'm with you. But Yosef was also before the Torah was given.
Right.
And we're deriving it from Yosef.
Right.
You bring up a good point. So let's say it's prohibited. Why would it be prohibited before the Torah was given? It's a good question. But we're deriving it from Yosef, who also lived before the Torah was given.
Okay.
So your point is well taken, but it still is a question.
Mm-hmm.
You have an answer?
No.
Okay. You have an answer? No.
So when they came to, I'm still not thinking clearly, but when they came to Mitzrayim, hadn't Yosef sent them food? They weren't.
Yes, but it wasn't 9 months beforehand that they received food from Yosef.
I mean, did they come without food? Were they starving at that time?
No.
Well, they weren't starving.
They weren't starving, but the world had a famine. It doesn't say in the Gemara.
Not if you're affected.
Well, Yosef had food, and Yosef still refrained during the years of famine. Yosef had all the food he needed.
So
he was in Egypt.
So famine exists, whether you're affected by it or not.
Yeah.
I see.
So this is a serious question. Seems to be contradictory. So Tosfos answers that this rule of the Gemara is not really a prohibition. It's not, even though, and this happens sometimes, even though, you see, when you read in Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, if it says something is prohibited, then it's prohibited. But the Gemara sometimes will use the term usur, prohibited, and the Gemara doesn't mean that it's actually prohibited. It means it's frowned upon. Sometimes it'll use the term usur when it really means frowned upon. So Tosfos says, when the Gemara tells us that it's prohibited, what the Gemara means to say is, it's a midas chasidus. It's a pious behavior. It's an appropriate behavior for pious people that during a famine, the couple should not be intimate. Yosef adhered to that pious behavior. He and Asnas held themselves to a more pious behavior, and therefore they separated during the years of famine. Levi and his wife, they didn't keep that extra pious behavior. They didn't keep the Midas Chasidus, that extra pious behavior. But it's permitted. So Levi and his wife, they did not keep the extra piety, and therefore it was permitted. And she conceived, and they had Yocheved. Yosef and his wife, they kept this extra pious behavior, and therefore their sons were born prior to the famine.
Well, they couldn't have been keeping the behavior when the famine hadn't set in yet. I mean, they didn't have any more children.
Well, yeah, but
but they had it before the famine.
You mean Yosef and his wife? Yeah, except that the Torah tells us specifically that they had the children prior, implying they would not have children during. That's how we know that they.
All right, you didn't have it.
Yeah. It's a good point. Yes.
Sorry to make that mention, but they didn't have any more children.
Who didn't?
Yosef.
Yes, that's true. But again, you know, that's a good point. But again, the way the Gemara derives it is from the fact that the Torah emphasizes they had the children prior to the famine. Okay. Now, the That's what Tosfos says. Now, I just want to, before I explain this, I want to make clear to you that. Thank you. I'm good. Thank you. It's okay. Thank you. We're good. It's not gonna. I want to make clear to you the term, because I spoke about this in another setting, and somebody in the group got confused. The term Midas Chasidus, which means extra pious behavior, has nothing to do with the Hasidic movement. One thing has nothing to do with the other. The Hasidic movement is a relatively modern movement. It's funny that we call it Hasidic movement modern, right? But it is a modern movement. The Hasidic movement only began a few hundred years ago. And the term Hasidus means extra piety. That's what it means. That term has existed for thousands of years, well before the Hasidic movement. And the Gemara in many places says this particular type of behavior is a midas chasidus. It is an extra pious behavior. Again, nothing to do with what, you know, whether you're from a Hasidic sect or not. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with behaving in an extra pious way. When the Hasidic movement began a few hundred years ago, they borrowed the term chasid. Because they were suggesting is if you behave in this manner, you will reach an extra pious level. That was a borrowed term that the Hasidic movement used, and so it has stuck. And therefore, we refer to the Hasidic movement as Hasidus. But that is not the context that it's being used in when you talk about these types of behaviors in the Gemara. The Gemara precedes the Hasidic movement by over 1,000 years. So at any rate, what Tosfos tells us is that by over 2,000 years, no, over 1,000 years, what Tosfos tells us is that that Yosef and his wife kept this extra pious behavior of separating during the years of famine. Levi and his wife did not. That's what Tosfos says. So that's fine. It answers the question. And so it's a really permitted behavior. It's just that there's an extra piety not to do it. Okay. What that brings up, the difficulty that brings up is that it's difficult to say that Levi did not engage in extra pious behavior. Because of all of the tribes, Levi is the one who we know becomes the priest, the most sanctified of all the tribes, the Kohanim, the Levim, he becomes the most sanctified. So to suggest for somehow that Levi, you know, he was just a regular person. He was rank and file. He didn't do these extra pious behaviors. It's just hard to swallow that. Tosu says it, so of course we have to accept it, but it's difficult. It's hard to understand that. So there's another element to this entire discussion, which is that the various commentators want to know when the Gemara says that it's appropriate for a couple to separate during years of famine, is that true even if the couple has not yet had a boy and a girl? As we know, the mitzvah of pruervu, to procreate, is to have minimally one boy and one girl. So let's say a couple has many children, many boys, many girls. Okay, so they should separate during years of famine. But what if they don't have a boy and a girl yet? They haven't yet fulfilled the obligation of pru or vu, of having a boy and a girl. Perhaps there it is more appropriate for them to actually have children, even though it's years of famine, because they haven't fulfilled the mitzvah yet. That's a discussion amongst the commentaries. And therefore the commentaries say that Levi, the reason why he didn't keep the extra pious behavior, because he only had boys. He only had Gershon, Kasa, and Merari. Didn't have any girls. Therefore, he did not keep the extra pious behavior. He and his wife did procreate during years of famine because he needed to have a girl to fulfill his obligation. And they did. They had Yocheved. That was their girl. So he fulfilled his obligation. So the difficulty with that is
Yosef
also didn't have any girls.
Yeah.
He only had Menashe and Ephraim. So then Yosef also should not have kept the extra pious behavior because he needed to have a girl. So we're back to our contradiction. It's very difficult to work this out. So what you see is that you have two conflicting behaviors. Each has merit, both for Levi and for Yosef. You have two conflicting behaviors, but both have merit. Now this happens frequently where a person can be in a position where I've got two things I could do. I can only do one or the other. They're mutually exclusive. Each one has an advantage and a disadvantage. What should I do? We struggle with decision making sometimes. We have, I don't know, should I take this job or should I take that job? Well, each job has advantages and disadvantages. I can't do both. And if I do one, I'm not doing the other, and the other opportunity will go away. Which one should I do? Should I buy this house or that house? Should I, right? People get into these big decisions, and it's, I don't know, there's advantages, there's pros and cons. So here you have two behaviors. Each has an advantage and a disadvantage. The two behaviors are the following. You have two people, Levi and Yosef. Each one had a dilemma. It's a famine. In a famine, there's an extra pious behavior that couples should separate and therefore not procreate. That is an extra pious behavior. On the other hand, both Levi and Yosef had not yet fulfilled their obligation of pru urvu, of having children. Therefore, it is appropriate to procreate. Which one wins? Is it better to separate during the years of famine, even though there's a disadvantage because they haven't yet fulfilled their mitzvah pru urvu? Or is it better to procreate to fulfill the mitzvah pru urvu, but on the other hand, that would mean they're not doing that extra pious behavior of separating during the years of famine? There's advantages and disadvantages. What is a pro and a con? What should they do? Yosef chose the extra pious behavior of separation over the importance of fulfilling his mitzvah of pru urvu. Levi chose the mitzvah of fulfilling pru urvu over the extra pious behavior of separation. Each one chose a different path. Was one right and one wrong? They were both right. They're both right. How do we know they're both right? You know how I know they're both right? We know they were both right because Yosef's behavior, the Gemara uses that as an example for this rule, that it's an extra pious behavior to separate during years of famine. We wouldn't derive that from Yosef if Yosef did something wrong. So if Yosef is held up as the example of the person who kept this extra pious behavior, must be he was right. Okay, so then maybe Levi was wrong. No, we know Levi was right also. How do you know Levi was right? Because the result of Levi not separating during this time was the birth of Yocheved. And no, it was the birth of Yocheved. And Yocheved completes the 70 souls. Hashem is saying, I'm putting my stamp of approval on Levi's behavior. Because Levi's behavior results in the completion of the 70 souls of the Jewish people. Had Levi chosen to go Yosef's path, Yocheved would not have been born, certainly not at that time, and the 70 souls would have been lacking. So the Torah is telling us both behaviors are appropriate. One can choose the behavior of Yosef, separation, because it's extra pious, times of famine. One can choose the path of Levi. I have a mitzvah to fulfill. I have to do pru urvu. One can choose either one. Why did Yosef choose his and Levi choose his? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know why Yosef chose to go down the road of separation. Levi went down the road of avoiding, of procreating for Pru or Vu. I don't know why they each chose their path. Don't know. Perhaps it has to do with Yosef's struggle with the wife of Potiphar. Perhaps that's his area of struggle. I don't know. I can't tell you why they chose the paths they chose. But both were correct paths. Two great people of the greatest of the tribes, Yosef and Levi, two of the greatest of the tribes, chose different paths, and both are correct. Both are correct. We derive a rule from Yosef's behavior, and Levi's behavior results in the completion of the 70 souls. A fascinating insight into the tribes. Remember, Yosef and Levi weren't with each other when this was happening. They didn't even know where each other was. Yosef was in Egypt, totally isolated from the brothers. Levi was in Israel, and they had nothing to do with each other. And they each had the same dilemma. There's a famine. I haven't had a girl yet. What am I supposed to do? Yosef says, separation. Levi says, procreation. So it's two different acceptable behaviors as long as each one has in mind the service of Hashem. That's always the caveat. As long as a person is saying, I am serving Hashem, then there's room for two different ways of doing it. Now, one has to be careful. One can justify all kinds of terrible behaviors by saying, I'm serving Hashem. Just because a person says they're serving Hashem does not necessarily mean the behavior is appropriate. However, there can be situations where there are two behaviors. Both can be appropriate, provided that a person is doing it l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. Both Yosef and Levi had the sake of heaven in mind, and therefore both behaviors in this case were appropriate. So now let's get back to our discussion. The Rashi tells us here on page 7, well, earlier, 738, Rashi tells us that, you know why Levi was counted from 30 days and up? Because this tribe was accustomed to being counted from the womb, min ha-beten, because Yocheved was born upon entering Egypt. So we asked several questions. We said, I don't understand. First of all, wasn't Yocheved's choice? And second of all, does that mean to say if it would have been another tribe, we wouldn't have counted that other person who was born at that time? And there were other children who were young. They weren't that young, but they were under 20 years old, and they're counted. So what are we saying over here? So it seems to me that what the Torah is saying is the reason why Levi is counted from 30 days and up is because Levi valued having children. Levi put the importance of having children on a pedestal. And he said, it is so important to fulfill the mitzvah of Pru Urvu that for me, that is going to supersede the extra pious behavior, which I would normally do, of separating during years of famine. Levi emphasized the mitzvah of Pru Urvu, of having children. Since Levi emphasized that, and as a result, Yocheved is born and counted towards the 70 souls, Hashem was sending a message that the tribe of Levi particularly should be counted from infancy. Because Levi, of all the tribes, emphasized the importance of having children, even at a time when there is reason to not have children. Nevertheless, Levi did. And therefore, this tribe, no other tribe, but only this one, is counted from 30 days and up. Fascinating insight into why this Levi was counted from such a young age.
I must have missed something, but the other tribes who counted went how?
20 years and up.
20 years and up.
Yeah, 20 years and up.
And was it only males?
Only males.
That
That's correct. That's a good. That would be another way to ask the question.
Right.
So, because we're not saying that Yocheved specifically should be counted from 30 days and up, or her descendants, we're saying that you see that Levi and his wife were, they valued having the children. In the birth of Yocheved, that's where you see it. But one, another point I wanted to make to you before we begin the next paragraph, I had told you that I had a very interesting exchange. I don't remember how much I told you, and I told you we're going to talk about it later, with my Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Weinberg, Zechar Vrachov, blessed memory, regarding Parshas Bamidbar and the various numbers involved in Parshas Bamidbar. I once said to my Rosh Yeshiva, to Rav Weinberg, I once asked him the following question. The Torah does basic forms of mathematics, basic equations for us here in Parshas Bamidbar. For example, the Torah does addition. The Torah takes the various numbers of the tribes, Reuven, 46,500, Gad, 45,650, etc., and adds them all up and says you have 603,550 in total. We could have added it up ourselves. Addition is not that complicated. We could have added it up ourselves. Torah even does it again with the various degolim, with the flags, where it takes three tribes and adds them up and gets the number for every quarter, three tribes. Again, we could have added it ourselves, and yet the Torah adds it up for us. The Torah also does subtraction for us. The Torah says that there were 22,273 Bechoros, firstborn. There were 22,000 Levim. The Torah says there were 273 extra. That's a pretty simple subtraction. And we could have done that ourselves. We didn't need the Torah to tell that to us. The Torah does multiplication. Torah says the 273 extra Bechoros each had to pay 5 shkalim. And then Torah says the total, 273 times 5, was 1,365. Again, we could have made that calculation all by ourselves. Yet the Torah does it for us. Even division is found in this parasha, although it's not as explicit, as the Torah takes 12 tribes and divides them into 4 directions, 3 on each side. So you find all the basic, the 4 basic mathematical functions are here in Parshas Bamidbar. So it bothered me, why would that be? So I suggested to my Rosh Yeshiva what I thought was a clever answer. The Gemara tells us, Histakel be'oraisa u'bara alma. Hashem looked into the Torah and created the world. The Torah, as they say, is the blueprint of the world. The Torah precedes the world. So Hashem looked into the Torah, and from the Torah created the world. It means the world is a reflection somewhat of the Torah. So, we know that all of the chachmos, all the wisdoms of the world, all mathematics, all science, music, all types of wisdom are embedded in the Torah somewhere. We may not be able to see it ourselves, but if one really learned the Torah in its full capacity, one would also become proficient in mathematics, in physics, in chemistry, all in languages, all wisdom is embedded in the Torah. Just that it's hard to find it, except for those who are incredible sages. So I suggested the following. If everything is in the Torah, that means not just the basic functions of mathematics are in the Torah, but everything's in the Torah. So that means calculus is in the Torah, quantum physics is in the Torah. It's all there somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I said, it would stand to reason that those functions that are simple to us would be more obvious in the Torah. Those functions that are more complicated and complex would be more obscure in the Torah. And therefore, since Hashem is looking into the Torah and creating the world, so even though it's true, quantum physics and calculus are embedded in the Torah somewhere, but they're not so obvious. And therefore, for us, they're also not so obvious. It takes much more study to understand those things. Whereas, the four basic functions of mathematics, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, which are explicit in the Torah, so therefore when Hashem created the world, they were simple equations, things that we have an easy time with. 2 + 2 = 4 is simple for us because it's explicit in the Torah. So I'm coming to answer my question. My question was, why would the Torah do these equations for us when we could do it ourselves? It's so simple. And I'm answering, no, you're putting the cart before the horse. It's the other way around. The reason why it's simple for us is because it's explicit in the Torah. Because the Torah added up these numbers, that's why addition is easy. Because the Torah made a subtraction, an easy subtraction case, well, that's why subtraction is easy. But you don't find that the Torah does calculus, and therefore calculus is difficult. That was my suggestion to the Rosh Yeshiva. Mm-hmm. In my Rosh Hashiva of Weinberg's Hamracha, in his inimitable way, he said to me, that's a gorgeous pshat, which means it's a gorgeous explanation, but it's kfira, but it's heresy.
Oh.
That's what
Why?
He said.
Why
he said, it's heresy to say that. He says, it's gorgeous, but it's heresy, which means he appreciated the logic, but he said it's patently false. So why is that? So he explained to me, because you find many times in the Gemara will ask a question. The Gemara will say, Kra lamali, why do I need a verse in the Torah to tell me a particular fact? Svarahu, it's logical. The Torah is written presuming that the human being who is reading the Torah and studying the Torah is coming to it with a certain degree of basic logic. You start with your own logic and then you begin reading the Torah. A person is expected on their own to figure out that 2 + 2 = 4 before cracking the book, before opening the Torah. It's not that the Torah teaches us 2 + 2 = 4. 2 + 2 = 4 is a basic logic that Hashem empowered the human brain to be able to understand. And that precedes the study of Torah. It's true that the world was created from the Torah itself, but nevertheless, the study of Torah presumes that you come into it with a thinking mind. And a thinking mind already knows 2 + 2 = 4, and for that matter, already knows that if you add up the 12 numbers of the tribes, you're going to get 603,550. And it is not the other way around. It is not that we get it from the fact that the Torah says it. It is logic that Hashem, in His kindness, gave our brains the capacity to understand. And that precedes the Torah. What I mean is it precedes the study of Torah. You come into Torah with a brain that is, thank God, thinking straight and thinking with logic. And then you start to study the Torah. So, that leaves my question unanswered. Then why does the Torah make all of these simple equations? If we're supposed to know all these things beforehand, these numbers are easy to add up, why does the Torah do so? So my Rosh Hashiva told me, the way one approaches these sorts of questions, although he didn't answer any of my specific questions, but he gave me guidelines for how one approaches these questions. So, I'm going to use for this the example of the life of Adam HaRishon. Adam HaRishon, we know, lived to be 130 years old, and then he had a son named Shace. Then he lived 800 years longer, And then he died at age 930. The Torah writes those three numbers. The Torah says he lived to be 130 and had a son named Shace. He then lived 800 more years and he had many sons and daughters. And then the Torah says he died at age 930. Now anybody, including young children in school, can add together 130 and 800 and arrive at 930. And my Rosh Yeshiva is saying, you know that without the Torah telling that to you. That's basic logic. And when you start studying the Torah, you have to know that already. So then why does the Torah tell us 130 plus 800 equals 930? So my Rosh Yeshiva said, the way to approach that question is to say the following. The Torah is telling us, you should know, there were two stages to Adam HaRishon's life. There was the stage before the birth of Shace and after the birth of Shace. Before the birth of Shace was 130 years. That's one stage of Adam HaRishon's life. And then there's another stage after the birth of Shace, which was 800 years. And then the Torah is telling you, but I want you to understand something. The totality of his life transcends those two stages. There is a combined number of 930. That 930 is different than 130 plus 800. It is a totality of 930. You know the idiom that the total is worth more than the sum of its parts, right? So that there's a totality there of 930 years which transcends the two stages of 130 and 800. Now, he didn't explain what are those two stages. What was the stage of 130? What was the stage of 800? And how does the 930 transcend? That's a good question. One can examine that, and one can do that, with all of the generations between Adam and Noah, where the Torah does the same thing and adds up those numbers the same way. But what he was giving me was guidance for the way to approach the question. That's the correct way to approach the question. Therefore, here in Parashas Bamidbar, the same thing applies. You want to know, I have 12 numbers, Reuven, Gad, Shimon, Levi, etc. They're all spelled out how many were in each of the tribes. And if you add them all together, you get 603,550. So why does the Torah add them for us? I could have added them myself. So the Rosh Yeshiva would say over here that each tribe had its number, and that number is special for that tribe, and it represents a certain totality of that tribe. But when you add it all together and you get the totality of the Jewish people, that number transcends the 12 parts that make it up. And it's a different number entirely. It's not simply each number added together to get the number 603,550. That's the approach to deal with this question. That's how my Rosh Hashiva guided me. And the truth is that even though when he told this to me, it was a little bit dissatisfying because I was looking for an answer. He didn't really give me an answer. But the truth is, he gave me something much more valuable than an answer because he gave me guidance to apply in other questions like this. And this really speaks to what one really can gain from a person of the stature of my Rosh Yeshiva of Weinberg, Zichron Racha. More than obviously the specific answers to the questions are very, very important, but more than the specific answers to the questions, the overall guidance of how to approach things is often more impactful. And I would give you an example, a different example where the Rosh Yeshiva gave us guidance. There's a famous story that is told. I don't remember which of the great sages of Europe this story happened with. I recall vaguely that it might have been Rabbi Akiva Eger, but I'm not sure. I don't remember which of the great sages it happened regarding which sage. But this sage was traveling. And he came to an inn, and he asked for a room. The innkeeper did not realize who he was dealing with. and the innkeeper gave him a room. The one who was traveling, I guess he was traveling incognito, he did not have with him his usual set of svarim, of books to read, of to study. So he asked the innkeeper for some Torah book, if he had any that he could study. So the innkeeper had a volume, I believe the story goes, of the Chidushei HaRashba. The Rashba is one of the Rishonim, one of the sages that lived, I believe he lived in the 13th century, I believe so. And he has commentary to the Gemara. And this innkeeper had a copy of that commentary and lent it to this sage. The next morning, the sage returned the sefer, the book, to the innkeeper. And he said to the innkeeper, "Thank you so much, I appreciate it. I studied it. You were missing a page." "You had a page ripped out. So I wanted to thank you, so I filled it in."
How amazing.
"So I filled in the missing page." So of course the innkeeper, when he saw that, he realized he was dealing with somebody of great stature, and okay, that's the story. That it's a relatively famous story. I had heard that various versions of that story throughout the years. My Rosh Yeshiva said to us, people misunderstand that story. People think, wow, he knew it by heart. Wow, he filled it in. The Rosh Yeshiva said, that was nothing for Rabbi Akiva Eger. Of course he knew it by heart. He said, that's not what this story teaches you. You didn't need this story to know that he knew it by heart. He said, what you learn from this story is, he knew it by heart, and he still studied it for hours. Mm-hmm. He didn't say, I know this already. It's boring. He still found in it new insight, new layers of understanding and depth. And he got it from reading the book, not from memorization, which he had it in his head anyway. But having the book in front of him with the words and studying it, he was able to find insight, because otherwise he'd be bored. Can you imagine staying up reading something that you know already and you're bored and you're just reading it over and over again? You don't stay up, you fall asleep doing that. But your mind has to be engaged. His mind was engaged, because even though he knew it all by heart, but there's still another layer, another insight. The Torah never ends. There's depth and more depth and more depth. And this sage was able to stay engaged despite the fact that he knew it all by heart. Maharishi Yeshiva said, that's what's so great about this story. So, again, it's a great insight, but really it's guidance. It's guidance, first of all, when hearing a story, to make sure you get the facts straight. That saying stories without getting the facts straight, and here I'm telling this to you without remembering who the sage was, that's not getting the facts straight. But to know the story and just to say it over in a superficial manner and not get the facts straight is a disservice. My Rosh Yeshiva, Ravayim Alexander Rachel, was very, very careful about that. And he held it was a disservice to say stories about great people without getting it exactly right. But more than that, he was also giving us guidance in not to become enamored by something superficial in hearing a story. But think through the angles. Put yourself in his shoes. I never thought of this, and I never thought of that. Put myself in Rabbi Akiva Eger's shoes, and someone hands me a book that I know by heart to the point where there's a page missing and I could fill it in. And I stay engaged and study it all night? I just never thought about that, because I got stuck on what was the superficial lesson of the story. And the Rashi was saying, don't get stuck on the superficial level of the story. Delve into it, understand it, realize what you're talking about, put yourself in the shoes of the people in the story if you really want to get insight into the story. Again, the guidance was almost more valuable than the specific answers to questions. A man of that stature, that's what one can really grow from. When a person comes in contact with a person like that, it's important to get guidance, a broad guidance for how to live and how to think and how to approach things. But that can be almost more impactful than specific answers.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.